Donc le séminaire d'aujourd'hui, c'est Areski Boudaoud.
Areski est physicien, a fait des très belles choses en mécanique physique, je dirais, pendant des années. Et puis il s'est passionné pour les plantes. Il a fait une démarche que moi je trouve très très courageuse, c'est qu'il a été s'installer à Lyon dans un laboratoire de biologie des plantes. Et donc depuis 11 ans, me disait-il tout à l'heure, il est physicien dans un laboratoire de biologie des plantes. Et il va nous parler de tissus qui sont un peu différents de ceux dont je vous parle, qui sont les tissus des plantes. Voilà.
Merci de l'invitation. Merci de l'invitation, Jean-François. Je vais juste par commencer par vous dire que je suis censé parler en anglais, mais je prendrai bien, sans problème, les questions en français si vous le souhaitez à la fin. So, I'm very much interested in morphogenesis, how an organism starts as a single cell and reaches a well-defined size and shape. So how do organisms achieve that? That's the underlying general question within the talk. So when you look at organisms at large scale, they seem to have well-defined shape. You can recognize them based on their shapes. But when you look at cell scale, things are much less organized. In this example, I'm showing you the population of stem cells at the tip of the shoot of a plant. And what is shown in color scale is the rate, the relative aerial growth rates. And so red colors correspond to cells growing at a high rate. Blue to slow rate or even shrinking slightly. And you can notice when looking at this picture, considerable spatial heterogeneity. So which at first sight seems to be in contrast with well-defined shapes at the macroscopic scale. So the type of questions that we will be addressing are, what are the sources of growth fluctuations? What are the links between fluctuations at different scales? And whether there are mechanisms behind the robustness of form. And this, this question will be clearer at the end. So, as you've been hearing very much, much more about animal systems, I put up together a few slides about plants. So that's the main system I work on, although I have some side projects on fishing yeast and on Drosophila. So, there's a whole list of concepts that were first discovered in plants. The concept of a cell, Robert Hooke, nucleus, chromosome, gene, you might recognize Mendel, viruses, and more complex biological concepts such as transposons, chaperones, gaseous hormones. All that were first; those were first discovered in plants. So plants are essential for photosynthesis. The composition of our atmosphere depends on plants. It rains in the middle of continents thanks to plants. And being in good health starts with a good diet. Plant tissues. Here are pictures of plant tissues seen at different scales. Seedlings here, cut through wood there. Here, a view of the epidermis of a leaf with the cells in the surface delimited by the blue contours and cells below the surface with a chloroplast seen in red. A section through a stem. And so, one essential component of what we will discuss in the following are cell walls, the separation between cells that are seen here, there. So plants are plant cells. In outside of their plasma membranes have a specific type of extracellular matrix known as a cell wall. And here are other pictures of cell walls seen at different scales, cuts through a stem, an electron microscopy picture of a cut through a stem too, a piece of cell wall, and a piece of cell wall seen at greater magnification. So here the typical scale is a few tens of nanometers. And what we're seeing is fibers fibers of cellulose. So a cell wall in a plant, so it's what sits outside of the cell, is composed of many polysaccharides, including cellulose, so the long fibers, and other polysaccharides, hemicelluloses and pectins, with which you might be familiar through jams. So the plant cell wall is a complex material that is dynamic. It's continuously synthesized by the cell and remodeled by enzymes that cut and make new bonds between pieces of the cell wall. And understanding the growth of a plant cell or of a plant tissue has an important, well, the, needs the understanding of how the cell wall changes in shape. So the cell wall is not specific to plants. Actually, animal cells are almost an exception. You find cell walls in archaea, in bacteria, in red algae, brown algae, all the groups that are, and fungi, of course, all the groups that are highlighted by, well, ellipses here. So in all these groups of species, cells are surrounded by cell walls. So they cannot evade the cell walls. So there's no migration as in animal tissues. And cells keep the same neighbors throughout the life of the tissue. So what are the important physical, mechanical components of plant tissues? So each cell is under pressure. So this pressure is due to the osmotic differences between the cell and the outer medium. So this, the pressure can reach a few megapascals, so much higher than the pressure in the tires of your car or of your bicycle. So they're, well, three orders of magnitude bigger than the values of pressure given by Jean-François for animal cells. So each cell is surrounded by an extracellular matrix, the cell wall, which can be viewed as a transversely anisotropic material, so with fibers that are tangential to the surface of the cell. So due to the high pressure inside cells, all cell walls are under tension, or almost all cell walls are under tension. And so this, when a tissue grows, cell walls expand. And when cells divide, they are, new cell walls are added between the two daughter cells. So growth is given by the tension in the walls, generated by due to the pressure inside cells, which is often known as Turgot pressure. All growth requires cells to import materials from the outside, and notably to bring water inside. Up to now, any question on plant tissues? So far, well, or until recently, most studies of plant cell growth focus on the cell wall and on the changes in the cell wall underlying growth. And hydraulics was neglected, was mostly neglected, so the movement of water between the outside and the inside of cells. So that's what we recently started to address. So what I will tell you about is mostly the work of Yu-Chen Long, who is a postdoc in my team, and involved the collaboration for the modeling side with Ibrahim Shaddadi and Christophe Goudin. So here's one of the starting points of the study. So, well, from the modeling point of view, Shaddadi and Goudin had started building a 2D vertex model for plant tissue growth. So this echoes what you've been hearing in the lecture before. But there are many additional mechanical ingredients. So from the osmotic point of view, all cells are assumed to be equal, so uniform concentrations of solutes. Water movement follows, the water moves between cells through small channels known as plasmodesmata. So the rate of water movement between cells depends on the differences between hydrodynamic pressure between the cells. So water moves between a cell and the outside through a semipermeable membrane, so the plasma membrane. And so water movement between a cell and the outside follows the chemical potential of water, also known as water potential. That corresponds to what happens to water. Then we need to model the cell walls. Each cell wall is assumed to be a viscoelastoplastic element, which is based on experimental data on growing on single growing cells. So the cell wall expansion to occur, the tension needs to be bigger than a certain threshold. Below this threshold, the cell wall behaves as an elastic body, and the rate of cell wall expansion is proportional to the excess of to the tension in excess of the threshold. So that's for the representation of the cell wall. Of course, this is a simplification because it doesn't account for how the cell wall is synthesized and the properties here. This appears as a purely mechanical model, but the parameters of the mechanical model depend on the chemistry of the cell wall. The viscoelastoplastic element that's embedded in the first equation here. This is the balance of fluxes of water, so between a cell and the outside and between cells here. So this is the rate of change of the volume of cell I, and this is a complicated way of to write the balance of forces at each junction. So everything is quasi-static. We assume mechanical equilibrium, and the dynamics is given by water movement and by the viscous component of the cell wall. So in this model, if we start with an artificial situation in which we have only 4 edge cells and 8 edge cells, shortly after you start the simulation, the 4 edge cells have higher pressure than the 8 edge cell. And this persists if we have a more realistic range of topologies. The level of the axis is missing. It's the pressure normalized by the average pressure, shown as a function of the number of edges of a cell. And so there's anti-correlation between pressure and number of edges. So this is qualitatively very similar to what occurs in foams, in liquid foams, which Jean-François mentioned before. So if water movement was fully limited for growth, so there are two limitations to growth: cell wall the cell wall viscosity and permeabilities of the different water conductivities. So you can have two regimes in which the cell wall is limiting for growth or water movement is limiting for growth. In the case of where water movement is limiting for growth, all cell walls will be at the threshold for expansion. So the tension will be constant in all cell walls. So we have this situation that is exactly the same as in liquid foams: constant tension at each wall and slow gas movements between the cells. So this explains this trend, and this trend decreases when water movement becomes less and less limiting for growth. So this is on the theoretical side. In parallel, we were looking at plant tissues, which were, this is a young flower bud, which were treated so as to inhibit cell divisions. So over a couple of days, cells, well, the flower buds would grow to something like this, which is visually quite similar to a liquid foam. So if we zoom on a couple, well, two cells, here there's a four-edged cell and a seven-edged cell. Over time, we see that the four-edged cell becomes convex, while the seven-edged cell is concave. And this is quite general, so convexity can correlates with a number of neighbors. And this suggests here that four-edged cell has higher pressure than the seven-edged cell. So, but well, there could be many alternative explanations to this observation, so we wanted to measure pressure in plant cells more directly. So the classical method to measure pressure within plant cells is to use a micropipette to impel the cell, so go through the cell wall. So this micropipette is filled initially with oil. When it breaks through the cell wall, the cell contents move outside because the cell is under pressure. And the experimentalist moves a piston on the other side to maintain the meniscus between cell contents and the oil at a constant position. And then there is a pressure probe on the wall, a pressure sensor on the other side that gives a reading of the pressure inside the plant cell. So as you can see clearly, this method is rather invasive. And in practice, it works only when the cells are big enough, so not in all cell types. And it's difficult to use it many times within the same tissue. So we developed an indirect method to assess pressure within single plant cells. And the basic idea is what you do when you want to check whether the tires of your bicycle are inflated, you press on them. So if you know exactly the shape of the tire, if you can measure the mechanical properties of the envelope, of the rubber envelope, you can actually deduce the pressure from the force depth probing. So that's what we developed. So in practice, we use atomic force microscopy. So we first scan the sample to determine the topography of the sample, and then we go over each cell and we press more deeply. So at a small depth like here, so this is a schematic of the cross-section of the cell, at small depths we're more sensitive to the mechanical properties of the cell wall itself. At larger depths, we're more sensitive to the pressure, but still a little bit to the mechanical properties of the cell wall. So we worked out a mechanical model of an inflated shell, and given the curvature of the cell that we have measured initially with the topography of the topographic model of the AFM. So here, the kappas are two curvatures of the cell. Given the thickness of the cell that we of the cell wall that we measure independently using electron microscopy, so we have an average value. So we measure the slope of the force depth curve at larger depths. This is the modulus that we deduce from small depth, so when the pressure is a function of all these parameters that we can actually measure. So we tested this approach in many ways, compared it to the classical method in cases where the classical methods can be used, and also using osmotic treatments where we change the osmolality of the external medium so as to change the differences in pressure between the two sides of the cell wall. We then applied it to the situation at which we were looking earlier, to tissues in which that are treated so as to inhibit cell divisions. So here we're looking at the tissue from above. So it's from confocal microscopy. So cell contours are in green. Here, it's what we obtain with the AFM. So cells are colored according to the pressure deduced from all the protocol that I described just before. And so the values of pressure are in the megapascal range, which is towards the higher end, but compatible with values in other systems. So pressure, the hydrodynamic pressure appears as heterogeneous, and if shown normalized by the average pressure versus the number of edges, is anticorrelated with the number of edges. So the correlation level is weaker than in the theory, but there are sources of experimental error and probably other sources of variability between cells in the real system. So if we look at the system in that wasn't treated, so soil-grown penile, so same here, cells are smaller because they're still dividing, and we measure pressure per cell, so this is one example. Values of pressure are in the, let's say, 2 megapascal range, and pressure is still is anticorrelated with the number of edges, with a, even with a weaker trend than before. And so one possible explanation is that because cells are continuously dividing in this system, this changes the number of neighbors at each division. And so the trend that I described before is a bit mixed and becomes weaker. So all together, we find that topological heterogeneity, so the number and the differences in cell neighbors, number of neighbors, induces in heterogeneity in cellular pressure, and also something that I haven't shown you here, in cellular growth rates. In some cases, untreated systems, cells with a small number of neighbors tend to grow at higher rates than the other cells, and it's the reverse in treated system, and we can account for it, for this, for the shift between the two in the model. So in passing, so I would just like to mention that we transferred some of these ideas to animal systems, and in collaboration with my colleague Muriel Gramont in Lyon, we looked at the pressure in nerve cells. So that's cells that are connected to the oocyte ovarian follicle of Drosophila. And we found that there was a gradient of pressure from the anterior to the posterior side, which is required for the elongation of the follicle, which starts as a round, very round, and elongates until it becomes the egg. So at small scale, or at cellular scale, we see spatial and temporal heterogeneity, so in growth rates, in mechanical status. This raises the question of how shape can be robust at a macro scale. So the best example in animals is bilateral symmetry. So, homework. So you take your two hands, you superimpose them. So in most individuals, two hands superimpose at better than 0.1%. And whereas if you look at the positions of the folds here, or the positions of the hair, they're different, clearly different between the two hands. And if you were to use a microscope and look at cellular patterns, they would be completely different between the two hands. So how come your two hands are so similar, whereas they haven't been talking directly to each other during your development? So plants are good systems to address that question because they repeatedly make the same organs, a type of organs that is rather insensitive to environmental conditions. So on a given plant, you would find flowers that are all similar to one to another. So here, don't pay attention to the petals, so the whitish organs, because there are different stages, slightly different stages of opening. But if you look at the sepals, so the green leaf-like organs that protect the flower, they all have almost the same height in all flowers. And so it's not a surprise that botanists have used flowers for classification of flowering plants. because flowers are very robust within a single plant and between individuals. So given cellular variability, how can morphogenesis be reproducible? And are there mechanisms that buffer cell-level fluctuations at macroscopic level? So that's the topic of the second part of the talk. So let's start to think about a situation in which we have a tissue where each cell separately has its own intrinsic growth rate. Say that the yellowish cell here wants to grow at a higher rate than its neighbors. So if he were isolated from the remainder of the tissue, it would grow, expand more in surface. So this means that within the tissue, it's pushing on its neighbors. So you'd predict a circumferential mechanical stress around the yellowish cell. So do plant cells react to this mechanical stress pattern? And what is the consequence of such reaction, if there is, on homogeneity of growth? So, plant cells are, as animal cells, respond to mechanical perturbations. So here I'm showing you one component of this response that can be made clearer by looking at microtubules, so part of the cytoskeleton. So one important point with those familiar with animal cells, in plants, in interface, microtubules are cortical, unlike animal cells where it is actin that is cortical. So functionally, microtubules play a role that is somehow similar to actin in animals. If we look at the catenin, so it's a molecule acts more or less as molecular scissors for microtubules, and hence its name. So katana is sword in Japanese. One way to perturb, among others, to perturb plant tissues is to remove cells locally or to kill cells locally. Plant tissues, the plant epidermis is under tension from the pressure of inner cells. So if we make an ablation in a wild-type plant, what we see is, here marked in green microtubules. So overall, there's a noisy but still an orientation, more or less circumferential, around an ablation. If in plants lacking catenin, in mutant plants lacking catenin, this reorientation is weaker, if visible. And so, the presence of the catenin modulates the response of the microtubule's cytoskeleton to external stress. So if we compress, for instance, if we take the plant and compress it in this way, we see also a reorientation of microtubules on average in this direction, and also with other types of mechanical perturbations. So this is why we wanted to look at whether the response of plant cells to stress has a role in growth homogeneity. So unlike in animal systems, the microtubule cytoskeleton has no direct effect on shape. It has an indirect effect on shape through the guidance of cellulose synthesis. So this is the same schematic of the cell wall as before, why I expanded on the cell side. And here you've seen a single microtubule with the cellulose synthase complex traveling along the microtubules. So what is known, well established now, is the orientation of microtubules establishes the direction of synthesis of cellulose, and so the direction of reinforcement of the cell wall, so the direction of fibers in the cell wall. So microtubules have an indirect role on the mechanical anisotropy of the cell wall. So if you think if a cell in which cellulose fibrils are circumferential, so a cylindrical cell in which cellulose microfibrils are circumferential, you'd expect the cell to grow more mainly in the perpendicular direction because the cell wall is reinforced in the around the axis of the cylinder. So now, if we get back to the thinking experiments that I was mentioning, this cell that wants to grow more than its neighbors, this will generate circumferential cell stress around that cell. So you'd expect microtubules to orient circumferentially in each around this cell, well, in each of the neighboring cells, and so cellulose synthesis to occur circumferentially. So you'd predict an hoop of cellulose around that cell, which may slow down the growth of the cell in the middle. So this could be a mechanism to make growth more homogeneous. So this is a hand-waving argument. So how does it work in the actual model? So this is what we worked on with Antoine Frulot. And what we did is to build the stochastic viscot model for cell wall expansion. So this is a cell wall. The cell is on this side. So the cell synthesizes new materials that are added to the cell wall. We assume that the cell wall is viscous if we look at long time scales. So there's a tension in the cell wall due to the hydrodynamic pressure inside cells. And to account for what I just described before, we assume that there is an increase in synthesis of the cell wall when the tension is bigger than the average, than a reference tension. So if the tension in the cell wall is anisotropic, is directional, we assume that there is more fibers in the cell wall deposited in the direction of that tension. And in addition, we assume that there are fluctuations in synthesis. So this is how the model actually looks like. So there is a constitutive relation linking stress, strain rate, well, which is defined classically from the velocity field, density, and pneumatic tensor that describes the anisotropy of the cell wall. We assume that we have mechanical equilibrium at each time point, so this is a quasi-static. And we have conservation equations for the density of the cell wall and for the pneumatic tensor of the cell wall, so for the quantity of cell wall and for the fibers, if you put it simply. So the left-hand sides are classical, so this is the time derivative, convection of the density by the velocity field. And the right-hand side corresponds to synthesis. For anisotropy, as anisotropy is a tensor, you'd have time derivative, advections, and co-rotations, omega being the curl of the velocity field. And then you have synthesis. And so what is, the basic physics that we account for in the model is in the synthesis terms. So we assume that there is an average rate of synthesis for the density, and that if the tension exceeds, this is the isotropic part of the stress tensor. If the tension exceeds the reference level, this increases the synthesis. And if the density decreases, this increases the synthesis as well. And same for the anisotropic part, with the pneumatic tensor here and the deviatoric part of the stress tensor. Yes?
What do you mean by synthesis?
Synthesis is addition of new materials to the cell wall. So we don't assume that there is, well, it's not, full mass conservation. We add continuously, the cell continuously adds new materials to the cell wall. So this model is rather generic, could be thought of also in the context of animal systems. What is specific is the form here of the feedback. So these are linearized. And by changing the signs and the time constants, this could also be used to describe an epithelium or the extracellular matrix in animal systems. So here, in the interest of time, I will skip a couple of slides. Yeah?
Where is the coupling? So I guess it's only between the pneumatic tensor and the constitutive relation?
Yes. So the constitutive, here we did only a linear analysis, so the constitutive relation is expanded around the reference state. And here the stress depends on the strain rate, the density, and the pneumatic tensor, the perturbations linearly.
Where do the microtubules play a role in oriented cells?
So the microtubules play a role in oriented cellular synthesis.
In your model?
Where is it? So it's.
Where are the microtubules hidden in your model?
So this is the second slide. So there are additional things in here. So the microtubules are hidden, integrated in the pneumatic, the pneumatic tensor S. So this describes the cellulose fibrils. Let me finish. So the cellulose is described here, and the effect, the response of microtubules to stress is embedded in this term. So it is the response of microtubules to stress that guides the changes in the pneumatic tensor due to the deviatoric part of the stress tensor.
So beta S hides the microtubules.
So beta S hides the microtubules and the dynamics of synthesis. So it accounts for the tool layers. Yeah. Thanks for the question. So, in addition, so we account for a stochastic component in synthesis. So synthesis goes by there's a small number of molecules that are synthesized at a given time, so there are statistical fluctuations. So we model them very simply, so as additional terms, small terms in the synthesis of, for density and for pneumatic tensor, which we assume delta correlated in time, so we implicitly assume that the correlation time is much smaller than other timescales in the problem, and that decay with space, with a characteristic length xi 0 here. So we needed to keep this characteristic length because there is no other length scale in the formulation of the problem. So we can look at many things in this model. So I'll just show you the two sets of results. One is statistical fluctuations in growth of a region of diameter x. So this can be computed explicitly from the model before. So if all regions in the tissue were growing independently, you'd expect the law of large numbers to tell you that the fluctuations in growth are proportional to 1 over the square root of the size of the system, so 1 over square root of the area, so 1 over square root, 1 over the diameter. So this is the dashed line here. If there were no spatial correlations, you'd expect the results to follow this line. So if all the tissue was growing fully spatially correlated, you'd expect this to be constant. So these are normalized by the growth, the fluctuations in growth at the scale x0, and this is plotted and normalized by a scale x0. And what we find in the model is that the situation is in between, that there are the fact that the system is growing induces long-range correlations that with more or less algebraic decay depending on conditions.
How do you choose the function g that you had on the previous slide?
So the form is not important. So for explicit calculations, we took an exponential.
No.
The exponential is arbitrary, but the results are obtained at scales much larger than C0.
And so the only thing that matters is that it has a finite decay length. That's
yeah, that's right. So that's one first point. So we are currently analyzing experimental data to see whether this is true. So basically, we live image sepals, so the green life organs that I showed you before. So here you see cell contours and cell nuclei. We quantify cell growth. So here the color scale corresponds to the growth rates of cells between two consecutive time points. And we analyze the same quantity as I just showed before, the statistical standard deviation in growth as a function of area, where we consider either as groups, either a cell or groups of cells, by enlarging the neighbors, the cell, its neighbors, the neighbors of neighbors, etc. And we see, so no spatial correlation would correspond to this line, and we see indeed that there is there seem to be long-range correlations. We still need to check a few things because there are many possible biases in this analysis for different reasons. So, it's likely, based on this, that there is also long-range correlations in growing plant tissues. So the other point that we looked at is the effect of the response to, the extent of response to mechanical stress. So in experimentally, what we do is we analyze organ contours. So each line, gray line here, corresponds to a contour of one sepal. So the red is the average contour. And by showing them this way, you can see the extent of fluctuations around the average contour between different sepals. So we would like to have the same, more or less the same quantities in analyze in the model. So given that there is the model is isotropic, so there is no preferred direction, analyzing this amounts to analyzing the statistical fluctuations of a vector, of the length of a vector. So this is what is shown here. It's the standard deviation of the length of a vector normalized by the average length as a function of time. So we see that this increases until what corresponds to the correlation time, the characteristic correlation time in the system, in the model, and then decreases over time, according to the law of large numbers. So to assess the extent of fluctuations, we can consider the maximum and plot the maximum as a function of other parameters in the system. So this is shown here as a function of the extent of the response to directional mechanical stress, so which corresponds to the response of microtubules to external stress. And so if it has high values, this tells us that the system is not very robust. Low values would correspond to higher levels of robustness. So we see that if we increase the level of response, the robustness increases. So this is what was expected from the hand-waving arguments that I showed at the beginning. But then it increases again. And somehow this is like an overshoot. So if we come back to the cell, the yellow cell that was growing at a high rate than its neighbors, if the other cells respond very strongly, they would completely stop the cell in the middle, and they themselves will be growing at high rates. So it's somehow an overshoot to the initial trigger. And this qualitatively explains there is an increase here. So this is something that we plan to test in experiments.
It's
just a measure of the amplitude of the curve. So you could define it here, but then you would need to map similar corresponding times in the different systems. So it would work too.
You think whatever are the fluctuations in between the end goal is to.
But so the decrease, this shape is the same for all experimental parameters. For all model parameters, and so it's just a way to measure the amplitude of this shape. So it wouldn't be a good measure necessarily if the correlation time varied a lot between the different situations. So this is something that we can test in experiments by comparing wild-type plants and plants with altered, where the microtubule cytoskeleton responds differently to mechanical stress. So here are the main points for the second part. So we find that there are long-range correlations in growing systems, and that variability in shape may be partially buffered by response to mechanical stress if, level of response is not too far from the optimum that we found. And to conclude, so here are the main points that I tried to explain to you. The first one is that there is a topology-based heterogeneity in cell pressure, predicted by coupled mechanical hydraulic models of plant growth and that we find in experiments. And the second point is that the responses to mechanical stress may contribute to robustness. And this is probably also connected with what Jean-François will consider later in the course in the mechanism for size determination. And the general take-home message is that there is information in fluctuations. So this is perhaps natural for physicists, but is less natural for biologists, which tend to consider only average values and not to analyze standard deviations. And so here, by looking at fluctuations, in this work and in our future projects, we hope to learn new features of tissue mechanics and shape establishment. So you've seen all the people involved in the work throughout the talk. So this is the current composition of the team. And thank you for your attention.
Do you have a qualitative argument why growth induces long range?
Yes. So we have short range correlations in synthesis. That are, if you say exponential to make it simple. So if you have growth at a constant rate, this means exponential stretching in time of distances. So you stretch an exponential by exponentially. This gives a power law. And
having a range which grows exponentially with time. That's what you're saying.
Yeah. So that's so that's the basic explanation, and then we find that a response to mechanical stress determines a correlation time, and this correlation time comes in the how the memory of the initial exponential is kept, and so this gives the exponents. Other questions? So you're too tired. Yes.
Yes, you said that there is information in fluctuation. What is what type of information? Biological, physical information?
Oh, so I use it in a very loose, with a very loose meaning. So all what you want. So that's a bit, well, the first answer. So for what we do, so what we have in mind is fluctuations in physical systems, whereby looking at fluctuations, you and responsely, well, in an equilibrium system, for instance, the temperature imposes the relation between the response of the system and the fluctuations that you can see in that system. So that's what the situation that we have in mind. But here we're very far from an equilibrium system, so we don't know very well the what the rheology is, etc. So we're I'm just using at this point in a loose meaning.
Question très générale. Est-ce que vous pouvez agir par les paramètres extérieurs sur la vitesse de croissance des plantes dans la mesure où on pense que pour les 10-20 prochaines années à remplacer les bétons par des bois et aussi pour la nourriture, les émojis, des choses comme ça?
Bon, il y a deux aspects dans cette question. Donc, là, comment agir sur la vitesse de croissance? Donc, dans l'absolu, il y a plein de façons. La façon la physico-chimique la plus simple, c'est de changer l'osmolarité du milieu externe. En gros, ce qui revient à changer l'accès à l'eau, le potentiel chimique de l'eau, et donc à créer artificiellement une situation de sécheresse ou d'abondance d'eau. Donc ça, et en fait, on sait très bien depuis très longtemps que on arrose. Alors ensuite, donc c'est l'ordre zéro. Ensuite, on peut penser à essayer d'agir sur l'efficacité métabolique de la plante ou sur la composition des parois. Donc il y a plein de gens qui essayent d'avoir des approches d'obtention de plantes transgéniques dans lesquelles les parois ont des propriétés différentes qui font qu'elles croissent plus vite. Donc ça, ce serait pour produire plus de bois ou qu'elles sont plus faciles à digérer chimiquement. C'est pour extraire produire des carburants à partir de parties non digestibles actuellement des plantes. Mais changer fondamentalement la vitesse de croissance, c'est compliqué parce que en fait, ce qui est limitant, c'est l'eau. Parce que l'eau, dans la production d'hydrate de carbone, il y a besoin d'hydrogène et l'hydrogène, il vient de l'eau. Donc c'est la limitation première. On peut jouer marginalement sur l'efficacité de la photosynthèse. Il y a des espèces où la photosynthèse est plus efficace. Mais bon, les plantes ont déjà eu beaucoup de temps pour évoluer et elles ont eu le temps d'optimiser le niveau de croissance. Alors ensuite, l'évolution optimise pas seulement par rapport à un seul paramètre, pas seulement par rapport à la croissance, ça a plein de choses en parallèle. À la résistance aux pestes ou à d'autres choses. Et donc, si on essaye d'optimiser la croissance, en pratique, les gens qui font des plantes transgéniques dont je parlais, quand ils font des essais en champ ou en situation un peu plus réaliste, ils voient qu'on perd sur autre chose, par exemple à la résistance aux insectes. Donc, c'est... Pour augmenter l'anisotropie ou pour changer
Manifestement, dans vos équations,
oui.
L'anisotropie intervient beaucoup.
Oui.
Je pensais que si on faisait une pression dans le sens vertical, je veux dire, il peut s'organiser des cellules. Enfin, je pensais à la vie sec, mais ça ne va pas aussi vite, bien sûr.
Disons qu'en exerçant des... des forces, même sans anisotropie, hein, on renforce les plantes qui poussent sont plus ont des résistances mécaniques plus élevées. Il y a des méthodes de culture traditionnelles où on piétine les plants au moment où ils sortent du sol et on pense que ça fait que les plantes sont plus résistantes à l'averse ensuite. Donc ça, c'est fait pour le blé et puis pour au Japon et pour le teff en Éthiopie. Et on pense que ça rend les plants plus résistants à l'averse après. Donc il y a un effet. Pour renforcer le bois, ça ne me semble pas très réaliste parce qu'il faudrait pouvoir tirer sur plein de plants enfin, en même temps. Et je ne vois pas comment ce serait faisable en pratique. Jean-François.
Une question sur les fluctuations de la synthèse que tu as montré. Le terme de densité, la synthèse, c'est de la pollinisation, non ?
Oui, mais c'est. Ah, alors,
est-ce donc, que c'est la nucléation qui crée les fluctuations ou est-ce que c'est la croissance des
pollinisations ? Je sais pas très bien. Alors il y a plusieurs donc dans la paroi, les différents composants ne sont pas synthétisés au même endroit. La cellulose est synthétisée à la surface de la cellule, et à un moment donné, il y a un nombre fini de cellulosynthases qui travaillent.
C'est un processus actif.
Oui, c'est un processus actif qui vient de la polymérisation elle-même. Donc il y a des fluctuations qui viennent de là. Ensuite, pour les autres polymères, ils sont synthétisés à l'intérieur de la cellule et exocytosés dans des vésicules. Et donc l'arrivée de vésicules est aussi stochastique. Enfin, peut être vu comme stochastique.
Et les deux mécanismes contribuent à ce que tu as
écrit. Oui, et plus peut-être d'autres que je ne connais pas.
Donc.
Pour l'instant, non, surtout parce qu'on a une description très réduite de la paroi, avec une densité et un tenseur pneumatique, alors que la composition est assez complexe. Donc, si on voulait rentrer dans les détails des mécanismes pour pouvoir donner un vrai sens à l'amplitude des termes, il faudrait faire, à mon avis, un modèle des différents composés de la paroi.
Oui, et là,
oui. Beaucoup. Hervé, tu avais une question ?
J'ai pas bien suivi ce que tu as pris en modèle au début assez rapidement. Donc ce que tu dis, c'est qu'il n'y a pas de différence de concentration de solubilité. Donc tu considères finalement les pressions
osmotiques constantes.
Une première partie du terme pour la croissance, finalement, on pouvait passer, il restait juste les champs hydrauliques. C'est ça ?
Donc les différences de pression entre cellules viennent des pertes, des sauts de pression liés associés à l'écoulement entre cellules ou entre cellules et l'extérieur.
Et ça, c'est parce que la croissance est limitée par la croissance du mur, et non pas par l'afflux d'eau. S'il y avait un afflux, si c'était l'afflux d'eau qui contrôlait, donc il y avait l'éponge.
Non, si l'influx, c'est plutôt le contraire. Hein. C'est si il faut que l'influx d'eau soit partiellement limitant. Donc, si on revient à l'image ou au cas des films de savon, enfin, ou des bulles de savon, donc dans une mousse, les cellules à peu de côté sont convexes, parce qu'à cause de l'équilibre mécanique, la tension est la même partout, et donc les cellules à peu de côté sont convexes. Et il y a un processus lent de diffusion des gaz. Dans les systèmes
exclusifs. Il y a plutôt depuis l'extérieur vers les cellules, pas entre les cellules.
Pardon ?
Il n'y a pas d'échange avec l'extérieur. Entre les cellules, oui, j'ai bien compris que c'est ça qui était limitant pour le processus global.
Oui.
Mais il n'y a pas d'échange avec l'extérieur qui fait que globalement le tissu.
Si, il y a des échanges avec l'extérieur. L'extérieur est un réservoir.
Et celui-là, du coup, il est également.
C'est pareil
c'est
que.
Pas limitant, en fait.
C'est pareil que dans les films de. Donc dans les mousses, il y a une seule nature d'interface. Il y a un réservoir extérieur de gaz. Il y a du gaz dans chaque bulle. et le gaz passe lentement des bulles à peu de côté vers les bulles à plus de côté. C'est le mûrissement. Bon, je ne vais pas t'apprendre ça. Donc l'eau a le même rôle que les gaz. Et donc dans le cas où il y a les différences de pression, c'est quand l'eau passe lentement, donc quand le mouvement d'eau est limitant pour la croissance. Je ne sais pas si c'est...
Je pensais à potentiellement s'il y avait des différences, il pourrait y avoir des différences maintenues de potentiel d'eau.
Ah, donc ça...
C'est un tissu et que ça pourrait du coup générer malgré tout d'autres types
de... Ça, on n'exclut pas cette possibilité. Donc nous, ce qu'on mesure expérimentalement, c'est juste la pression hydrodynamique. Alors on peut avoir des idées sur la pression osmotique en traitant les plantes avec des solutions concentrées. On augmente la concentration et on regarde quand est-ce que les cellules se détachent des parois. Au moment où elles se détachent des parois, elles ont la même pression osmotique que dans le bain extérieur. Donc à la précision de nos mesures, on ne voit pas de différence de pression osmotique entre cellules. Mais c'est très peu précis parce que ça dépend de la dynamique de pénétration des solutés dans les parois et de la gradation de solutions qu'on utilise. Donc je dirais qu'à 10 ou à 20% près, il n'y a pas de différence de pression osmotique, mais peut-être qu'il y en a quand même. Les cellules pourraient sentir leur état de pression hydrodynamique et compenser en changeant la pression osmotique. Et ça pourrait être une explication de pourquoi les tendances qu'on voit sont beaucoup plus faites, expérimentalement sont beaucoup plus faites que dans le modèle. Mais c'est une explication parmi d'autres.
Merci.